welcome to Worst Bestsellers, where we read about the dangers of a secular liberal arts education so you don't have to. I'm Renata.
And I'm Kate.
And for this episode, we read This Present Darkness by Frank Peretti. Joining us to discuss this Christian Mingle-approved thriller is Izzy Wasserstein, author and Demon of Regrets.
Hi, I'm so delighted to be here.
Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. And congratulations, by the way, on your new book, which is called These Fragile Graces, This Fugitive Heart.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to have it out in the world.
Yes. I will also say, normally when we have an author on the show, I like try to read their book before they come on the podcast so I can be like, wow, great book. But you've read this on yourself because you suggested this book and it was so long. I didn't have time to read your book.
It is so long. I did not realize when I suggested how long it is.
But I have seen the starred review for These Fragile Graces, This Fugitive Heart, and I look forward to reading it.
Well, thank you. I could tell you it's a lot more queer and fun, I hope, than This Present Darkness.
Oh my gosh. Yes, so I look forward to reading it, but for now we have to talk about This Present Darkness. And so before we get too deep into This Present Darkness, we got some content warnings to throw at you. They're sort of hard to quantify. There's a lot of false rape accusations, but I don't think any actual rape. So that's something.
That's a low bar we've got that this book has managed to clear. Yeah.
Demonic possession, murder / suicide / suicide by demon? I don't know. I don't know how to quantify these crimes. And then just from like talking to people in my life about this book before I started recording, I think if you grew up in some flavors of Christian fundamentalism or evangelical or whatnot, just this author's name may be upsetting to you, I've learned. Anything else we should let people know about before we get into the wild world of this book?
No,
anti-whale. This book has an anti-whale agenda that I found offensive.
So anti-whale. It's anti-video games as well, but I don't think that needs a content note.
Yeah.
Anti-psychology, which is...
Oh, yeah.
Like, strong anti-psychology, which maybe gets hand-in-hand with the, like... Christian fundamentalists, but like, yeah.
Also weirdly pro cop, but in like the strangest possible way.
That is true. So this book also, when Izzy suggested this, I had literally never heard of this author or this book because I grew up a godless whale lover. So this is unfamiliar to me. And then I read the Wikipedia page for this book, so now I know everything about it. And I learned that it came out in 1986. Sales were initially slow, but jumped dramatically after singer Amy Grant promoted the book. And what the fuck, Amy?
Oh, Amy, why?
Amy, you know you can't turn the Titanic around. You know it. okay, so Izzy, you mentioned you had read this book when you were younger.
Yeah, I think I was maybe 12 or 13, and I was raised an evangelical Christian kid and like was desperate for anything vaguely fantasy that was, you know, evangelical approved. So I read this and I remembered it vaguely. Like, I remembered liking it at the time and was certain I would dislike it now. But I really did not remember that it was really long and like varied between very boring and deeply upsetting. So I was not prepared for that.
It's also, and we've had other books like this where I'm like, I'm not really sure how you achieve this, but it's a book where a lot of things happen, but it's still very boring.
It's, and I feel too, like, because when you first suggested it, I was like, oh, this could be funny. And I think if it was half the length,
yeah,
it would have, like, This is a long book.
Yeah.
It's so long. And there are passages where, like, at one point, one of our heroes is driving down a road and it describes him turning left.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll do things like you're in an office, you learn how the copier works. Like, you can't just say, like, she made copies. Like, she put it on the glass. She hit the button. Like, okay. Okay.
There's a whole saga about a coffee maker that comes to nothing. It's just frustration that they can't make coffee.
Yeah, and then later they're flummoxed because it turns out it was a phone cord and not the electrical cord to plug the coffee maker into the wall. Like, these people have huge, they don't know how electricity works, but they use it energy. Wow. Okay. So this book, it's set in the small college town of Ashton.
Ashton.
Yes. I started to say it, and then Ashmont started to come out of my mouth, which is on the red line, and not well, actually, you know what? Ashmont probably is also taken over by demons. Probably everywhere in Massachusetts is pretty infested with demons, by Frank Peretti's standards.
I think that's a safe bet, yeah.
So we're in the college town of Ashton, and it starts off in the Ashton Summer Festival, which I really have to... We can't go through, like, every beat by beat, but it starts in the summer festival, which is, quote, a wild time, a chance to get drunk, pregnant, beat up, ripped off, and sick all on the same night. And it's basically, like, a carnival. It's, like, a small-town carnival, but somehow it's, like, so godless and terrifying, and, like, the town reels for the week after from the aftermath of a carnival.
Well, and isn't the town supposed to be like 12,000 people? Like, it's a really small town. And they make a point of saying that they're like busing in sex workers for this carnival. I do not understand.
No. And so because they have brought in these sex workers from other town, somehow this star journalist Bernice, who writes for the town's newspaper, the Ashton Clarion, she has been arrested at the carnival also she's been brought in on charges of prostitution, even though, of course, she would never do that.
She would never.
And so she is upset, and, like, it is, again, this book is anti-cop in the weirdest way, where, like, she's railing against, like, how bad the conditions are in the jail and how unfair it is and, like, blah, blah, blah. But then it's totally fine to leave the other women there. It's just that, like, she didn't deserve that. So she gets out.
Yeah. And she, very particularly, she is upset because she presented her press credentials and explained several times and claims that the police chief was there who knows her and knows that she's a reporter, and, like, literally, like, turned his back on her when, not metaphorically, like, literally turned around so his back faced her when they were putting her in the cop car to arrest her.
Yes. His name is Art Brummel. He's going to be a pretty major player, I guess.
Alf Brummel, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think I auto-corrected Art. You're right. It's Alf. They say Alf so many times. How could I forget my good friend Alf?
There's even a point later where one of the characters hears Alf's first name on the phone and wonders if that is, in fact, Alf Brummel, as opposed to all the other Alfs running around town.
When did the TV show Alf come out? Maybe they meant the alien. But also, and this is the case throughout the book, is occasionally we just jump to Angel POV. Oh, Alf came out in 1986, the same year as this book. What does it mean? Throughout the book, we're getting Angel POV, where the multiple angels are watching over the town, and they sense evil, but they are sort of limited in what they can do about it. But they somehow are behind pointing Bernice toward this photograph she took at the carnival of some notable figures talking at the carnival. This is very suspicious. Why would you talk to someone at the carnival?
Yes. So Bernice's boss is Marshall Hogan, who is the new which is important, editor of the Clarion and also owner.
Yeah.
He moved from New York to buy a small town newspaper and be the editor of it.
Yeah, and he used to work for the New York Times.
Yeah.
This all makes perfect sense. Don't worry about it. Don't think about it too hard.
He moved to town, as I said, recently, and he lives with his wife and his daughter, Sandy, and he's upset because his relationship with Sandy has always been tenuous, and it's somehow gotten worse since they moved to this town and she started going to the college and taking psychology classes.
Terrible.
So he gets Bernice out of jail and is like, how did you even get arrested? And she tells the whole story. And he's like, well, that's just silly. Like, I'm sure you're just being a silly woman about it. And then the more she talks, though, and the way everyone is acting suspiciously, he's like, okay, maybe there is something to this. Maybe something weird happened that night with this group of people that she claims she photographed.
Yeah, which was, it was Chief Alf and then Pastor Young of the UCC church, and then, quote, some blonde woman, some short, pudgy old fellow, and a ghostly-looking black-haired shrew in sunglasses. Sunglasses at night. And night is italicized. At the carnival. Can you believe? Yeah, the college, it's Whitmore College is the town college, and so Sandy lives at home and attends that college. Which I was confused about at first because I'm a coastal elite, I guess. Anyway.
So Marshall goes to pick Sandy up from college and decides to go into the building and into the class that she was in, which is, what the hell is the woman's name?
Oh, it's called Psychology of Self, and it's taught by Professor Julene Landstrat.
So he decides that he's going to, like, sit in on the class, and then she yells at him and tells him to leave.
I'm going to read a little bit of this segment as an early dramatic reading, just to give you a sense of what you're in for with this. Psychology of Self class was more of that college stuff, that funny conglomeration of $64 words which impress people with your academic prowess but can't get you a paying job. Well, that's too real, Marshall. Marshall smirked to himself a little bit. Psychology. If all those shrinks could just agree for a change, it would help. First, Sandy blamed her snotty attitude on a violent birth experience. And then what was it? Poor potty training? Her new thing was self-knowledge, self-esteem, identity. She already knew how to be hung up on herself. Now they were teaching it to her in college. And then the professor is like, oh, hey, like, strange man in the back who just wandered into class, like, get out. And then he's in the hallway sulking. Who stole the no parents allowed signs? How was I to know she didn't want me in there? And just what's so all-fired precious and secret that she doesn't want any outsiders to hear it?
Well, bud, why don't you pay tuition?
Yeah.
Right?
And then you can find out.
I just keep imagining what it must have been like for the students in that class, or for her, to just have, like, some random person wander into the classroom partway through, like, well into the semester. Just be like, well, here we go. As though that's a normal thing that humans do.
Right. And I feel like this does tie into, like, the, you know, the conservative belief now of, like, well, I should be able to just, like, drop into school anytime I want and see what, you know, see what critical race theory my children are learning. And it's like, you can't just come into school.
Right.
Anyway, angels are also watching.
Sandy's mad that he would do that and that he would be existing anywhere in the world generally based on her attitude towards him, which is not all that different from many other teenage girls that I have known. And concurrent to all of the troubles that Marshall is having with his newspaper and his reporter and his daughter, we've got Hank, Hank Bush is the new, again, pastor at the other more holy church in town. And he is dealing with a vote of no confidence because he kicked out a guy who was having an affair from the church. And now everyone wants to vote him out as pastor. And we learn that he was never supposed to be pastor in the first place. There was another guy that after the previous pastor left was supposed to be voted in, but the angels intervened and made it so that Hank, who's a good godly pastor who loves God and praying, would actually be brought in and not this, like, you know, new age liberal God is for everyone type pastor that the forces in the town wanted to bring in.
And again, all of this is so funny to me as a godless youth, because I know a little more now, but especially when I was younger, I was just kind of like, all Christians is Christian. And this idea that, like, no. Some of you Christians are trash. Some of you Christians are basically devil worshipers. Like, it's so funny to me. Like, it's all the same book. It's all the same guy. What are you doing? This is a hot take that will get me canceled by someone, I'm sure. But, like, the devil, I guess. The devil will cancel me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are a few things that a certain kind of Christians love more than decreeing that other Christians aren't real Christians. It's a whole weird thing.
Well, my hot take is that's silly.
It's so silly.
Also, not a Christian, but this idea that, like, he's the good pastor because he kicked out an adulterer from his church. Like, isn't your whole thing, like, forgiveness? Shouldn't you, like, help this guy? No, get out, I guess. Which is, to be fair, then later they kind of do let him back in and they help him. But, like, they're, to me, like, they're setting up Hank to be this, like, beautiful, godly, heroic figure. And I'm like, he seems like a dick.
Yeah, I think characters display their godliness in this book by being colossal dicks to everyone. That's sort of the way they show that they're pure.
So then we see a bunch of angels are having, like, an angel party watching over Hank's church. And again, I just want to read the description of the angels, because they're all, it's a little horny. I do think Frank Purdy is, like, a little horny for the angels. And that's fine, I think. Okay, so we've got Nathan, the towering Arabian who fought fiercely and spoke little. Armoth, the big African whose war cry and fierce countenance had often been enough to send the enemy fleeing before he even assailed them. Chimon, did they say Chimon or is it like Chimon?
I don't remember.
No idea.
I listened to this book at like 3x by the end.
Okay. I'm going to go with Chimon. Chimon, the meek European with the golden hair who bore on his forearms the mark of a fading demon's last blows before Chimon banished him forever into the abyss. Creoni, a tall, dark-haired warrior and watch-carer of our prayer warrior, Hank. And then the captain of the host is named Tal. Or Tal?
Tal.
Tal. And he's tall. And his name is Tal, with one L. And he is an impressive figure with golden hair and ruddy complexion, intense golden eyes like fire, and an unchallengeable air of authority. And then later we also get Mota, who's a burly Polynesian, and Sion, a red-haired, freckled fighter from the British Isles. So we've got, like, the United Colors of Benetton of angels. And they're all watching over. And this is something we've talked about, like, before recording, of, like, what exactly, like, can the angels die? And, like, they're always, like, they're all these warriors and they're fighting and they can be injured and heal themselves. But it seems like there's not really any stakes, because I don't think the angels can die.
But they seem like they think they can, right? Because, like, at one point, one of the demons threatens that he's going to kill one of the angels, and the angel responds as though this is a possibility.
Yeah. So maybe they can die, and Frank Peretti just, like, thought he would be struck by lightning if he wrote an angel dying. I don't know. But the demons don't really die either. They get sent to the abyss. But then they can come back from the abyss, because some of the demons we learn have, like, been in the abyss for, like, thousands of years, but now they're coming back to, like, specifically target this small college town.
Yeah, as best I can tell, they, like, respawn on a counter and then come back.
Yes. But also, meanwhile, the demons are meeting in town. And so our angels all mostly have names, even if they're sort of like goofy fantasy names or whatever. The demons are named complacency, lust, deception, murder, lawlessness, jealousy, divination, rebellion, sorcery, fortune telling, confusion, witchcraft, rape, and Lucius. and Prince Rafar. But also, like, a lot of these demons sound cool as hell. Like, who would you rather hang out with? Angel Nathan or demon witchcraft, demon fortune telling, demon rebellion? That's what I'm inviting to my party. Like, rape and murder can't come, but a lot of these other demons can hang, I think.
Right?
Anyway, so these, by the way, angels and demons are constantly just having little meetings. They're all like middle managers where they're like, what's the status update on like Hank's church? And so, I don't know, probably 20% of this book is just like angel and demon meetings. And so we're not going to describe everyone, but just if we haven't mentioned it often enough, just imagine every so often we're popping back to like just demon chat, angel chat. What are they talking about? Sometimes they're just recapping the book to each other.
They really are. This book has so much filler for a book that is long, right? Like, it doesn't... I don't understand why there was no editor here, apparently.
Well, that's why this book wasn't popular until Amy Grant made it, so.
So, we learn about the demons and the angels, and Marshall complains to his wife that, you know, he and Sandy are so far apart, and there's all these... Well, no, what happens first is both Marshall and Hank wake up in the middle of the night in their houses and feel like this oppressive darkness.
Oh, yeah.
Like there's someone in the house, like they're being attacked spiritually. And Hank is like, oh, I have to pray about this. And he prays, and then like it's enough to drive the demons away. And then Marshall does something I don't remember because it was so long ago. I've lived 80 years since I started this book. And also the demons are driven away. But then he realizes that Sandy has packed a bag and left the house. And he's like, well, shit. And is complaining, like, he and his wife are very nervous about this. And his wife's less nervous. She's like, maybe she went to a friend's house. We should call them. And he's like, well, it's the middle of the night. We can't call anyone now.
Yeah, they're just not that worried.
Yeah.
Which is fair because she is a 19-year-old woman.
Yes. And his wife's like, maybe you should talk to our pastor about it. Pastor Young. And he's like,
I want to read this quote. Okay. And he's like, no, I want to talk to Pastor Young. Because, quote, maybe Pastor Young's just a little too cush, you know? He's into all this family of man stuff, discovering yourself, saving the whales. And they're a United Christian Church, which is that's our church I've heard of. That's real. And they can get fucked. They don't care about God. They care about saving the whales.
This also sets up a very important thematic concern of the book, which is characters getting excited about making phone calls.
Yes. Oh my God. That, between that and like a constant discussion of office furniture.
Office furniture, office supplies. Yeah.
The amount of time, like one of the first big office furniture scenes happens when Marshall goes to talk to Alf about Bernice being arrested and all that. And there's this gigantic aside about his filing cabinet. It just goes on and on about how, like, his old shitty filing cabinets versus the new filing cabinets that he got. And there weren't dead bodies in those filing cabinets. So I can't imagine, like, it just...
You know what? I hate to come in and defend Peretti for a minute, but I do think at least that part was sort of foreshadowing for the later reveal that the chief has, like, redone his office to make it full of phone tapping equipment.
I guess...
But it's real boring.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what he's going for. But, like, if you're going to set up a cool reveal, you don't need to spend pages and pages, like, giving us the clues, right? Like, that kind of defeats the purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially when the clues are so boring.
So he's like, Marshall's like, okay, yeah, I guess I'll go talk to Pastor Young, and goes to talk to Pastor Young the next day. And it is like this weird, like, battle of good versus evil within the pastor's office, from everything to like the size of the chairs to like, yeah,
more chair talk.
Again, the amount of office furniture talk in this is absurd. And Pastor Young is like trying to be like, oh yeah, like, you know, I bet it's fine, you know, young people with college and all. And
he's like, this woman at the college is teaching her self-esteem. Isn't that disgusting? And Pastor Young's like, I don't know, that seems okay. And yeah. Marshall's like, terrible, get fucked. And then also he asks, he's like, hey, do you know that professor? And do you know the chief of police? And Pastor Young is like, no, I don't. And he's like, did you go to the carnival? And Pastor Young's like, no. But Marshall knows he did go to the carnival and he did meet with those people. So not only did this professor love whales, he loves lying.
Yeah.
It is impossible to overstate how dumb the various conspirators, including Pastor Young, are here. Like, they just constantly give information that is going to be easy to refute and make their lives harder.
Yeah. So
we're checking back in on Sandy. She slept at the bus depot because she was mad at her dad.
And then she went to class, and on campus is hungry and tired and like gets food, and then is just going to cry because she's so upset about her choices and her confusion about like her life and what she is doing and like running away from home and all of this stuff. And then this guy, Sean, is like, you look sad, how can I help? And brings her back home and makes her parents promise before he'll let her come inside that they're going to like try to understand her and be good to her and not fight with her all the time, which is just was a weird scene.
Yeah. Well, it's like, oh, that's a nice thing to do. No, he's a demon. So things start picking up because Bernice and Marshall, our intrepid journalists, are like starting to interview their people who have been run out of town. And the way that this book, so, like, the former newspaper editor was run out of town for allegedly molesting a 12-year-old girl, which is horrible, but he didn't really do it, so it's just, like, this, the way that this book, okay, this book is weirdly, like, a reverse satanic panic, but also a real satanic panic, where, like, it's so easy for bad people to make a fake rape accusation and have it, like, ruin this person's life and get them run out of town, but also there are real demons that are possessing people and making them do this.
And our New York Times reporter, right, hears this story, talks to this guy, and just takes him at his word that, like, oh, there was nothing to those allegations. They were all trumped up. And, like, he doesn't investigate it any further than that. He just is like, okay, that sounds right.
Yeah. We get a little Bernice backstory dump where she's a reporter, but really she's trying to investigate the death of her sister, Pat, because Pat's death had been ruled a suicide, but Bernice knows her sister wouldn't do that. And spoiler, she's right. It was a demon.
It's always a demon in this book.
It's always a demon. So we're going around town, like things are escalating. The demonic attacks are getting more like literal. On, like, Hank's wife gets, like, attacked by a demon at the grocery store. This sexy slut named Carmen comes and gets a job at the newspaper and also, like, tries to seduce Hank, but he's too godly, of course. But then she starts spreading false accusations about Hank, and everyone believes it because everyone believes women all the time, obviously.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. And we find out through Marshall and Bernice's snooping that Langstrat, the professor, is part of a group that another psychology professor has dubbed the Inner Circle, which is all of these people around town, including the people we saw her with the night of the carnival, Alf, the police chief, and Pastor Young, but also like regents of the college and the deans. And they are slow. And after talking to the people who were run out of town, they discover that it has infiltrated all of these different departments at the college and other like bigwigs in town. And it is like this new age cult where Langstrat meets with them and does like meditations with them.
Have you ever heard of anything more godless than meditation?
And like they're uniting under one consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, their group is called the Universal Consciousness Society.
It's very silly. so they're trying to uncover all of the everyone who's involved in this and like how it's like taking over the town so that the town will be more open to saving the whales, I guess, and less about Jesus. And Jesus really wants to be the center of attention, one would assume. Fuck the whales.
Fuck the whales. Also, when they meditate, they're like, sometimes they're chanting the name Rafar, which is the demon prince.
Yeah.
One of the demon princes.
And at no point does this book seem to notice that, like, it the way it describes meditation is actually very close to the way it describes prayer. Yes. But we were not supposed to notice that at all.
Speaking of the way this book describes prayer, one of many beefs I have with it is the way that Hank, we never really get quotes from Hank's sermons. It's extremely tell, don't show. It's like Hank preach. And it was such a good sermon. Everyone loved the sermon. Everyone saw the truth of it. Everyone, you know, understood instantly the light of Jesus. But we never really get, like, sometimes we'll have him quoting Bible verses, but there's not like, and we've talked about this kind of thing before where it's hard if you're like, and then this character sang the greatest song in the world, and then you have to write the song. And if you don't write the greatest song, then it looks stupid. But it also looks, especially when it's like this, and it's like, you know, this is like an evangelical text. Like, you want to be convincing me, the reader, that Jesus is great. And you can't, you just have to be like, trust us. Trust us. He said that Jesus is great, and he is totally great.
I, the author, cannot even imagine what a compelling sermon would sound like. But trust me, they are great.
So at one point, back with Hank, we had already said that his wife got attacked at the grocery store, the bad grocery store now, because also run out of town have been like the good Christian grocer. And he's been replaced by someone else.
And you know what? For all the dumb details this book gives, I do wish that it had gone into more detail about the bad grocery store and been like, it has tofu. It has green tea. Like, I just wish he had listed all the godless foods that it had now, but he doesn't.
Hank, and we had said, like, you know, this woman had tried to seduce Hank. Another fun thing that Hank does is God leads him to an arcade.
Oh, yeah. Which, and the arcade is called The Cave. And also, this town is not that big. And Hank is like, he had heard of this place before, but he never knew where it was. Like, you didn't ask? You didn't, like, look at a map?
And nope. Like, as I was, I don't know if it said this in the text, because I was listening to it pretty fast and also doing, like, 55 other things at once, because you can't sit still while listening to this book. It's so boring. But, like, I'm trying to listen. Like, at first I think, like, did he just walk into a brothel? And then it's, like, and you see, like, the piles of more quarters than Hank has ever seen, and people standing at video games, and I'm like, oh, it's an arcade. Like, it's just an arcade? He just went to Chuck E. Cheese. Like, what?
The Devil's what? Chuck E. Cheese, which I think is just Five Nights at Freddy's.
I think you're right. And Hank, like, runs into this guy, Ron, who, like, is just, like, a teen. And
his parents have now come to Hank's church because, by the way, after after the bad people left Hank's church, a bunch of other people have been like, oh, I heard your church is good because you love the Lord so much. So we're going to come to your church now.
Yes. And so he finds this kid and he's like, I'm going to pray for you. And the kid's like, fuck prayer. And then he's like, no, I'm going to keep praying for you. And like, God has him see the demons who are around him. And the demons are like witchcraft and
fortune telling.
And he names them out loud in his prayer, like, the demon fortune telling, please leave this child.
Yeah. And then they fucking do.
And the kid is like, oh my God, like, actually, I do love Jesus. And I hear people talking about praying all the time. And I thought it was stupid. But actually, I think I'm going to try praying now.
This is a book that both wants us to believe that demons are the scariest imaginable things. And that you can defeat them by a combination of prayer and just telling them that Jesus said to go.
Yeah.
It's really hard to sustain dramatic tension when that's how you beat the bad guys.
Yeah. I will say, I was talking to a friend who was like, oh, I read this book when I was in middle school and I was so scared of the demons. And I was sort of joking, but I was just like, why? It sounds like all you have to do is just like invoke Jesus' name and then they could leave immediately. And she was like, I guess I didn't think of that. I was like, so this... This book fails on an instructional level.
And then this is like my fucking favorite part. No, my favorite part is when he's like, witchcraft, go away. And witchcraft is like, yeah, okay. Is when he's like, the kid just like talks to the pastor. And like, the pastor always seems to bring things around to Jesus, but the kid didn't mind that much. And then by the end of it, he was like, actually, I want to hear more about Jesus. And he just like talks about Jesus more. And then he's like, I'm going to go to church on Sunday. And it just like, it felt like such a like missionary instruction manual, like
yeah.
Talk about the things they like, but then kind of bring Jesus in and eventually they'll just want to hear about Jesus.
Yeah. Oh, here's the direct quote. Ron didn't mind. Ron began to notice that no matter what the subject or the issue, Hank had a way of bringing Jesus into it. Ron didn't mind. This wasn't like a phony sales pitch. Hank Bush really believed that Jesus was the answer to everything. So after talking about everything else with Jesus brought into it, Ron let Hank talk about Jesus. Just Jesus. It wasn't dull. Hank could really get excited about him. And again, well, how does Hank talk about Jesus? It's not boring. Don't worry about it. It's not boring.
What's boring is video games, of course. Jesus is awesome.
I would rather hear about Jesus than Pac-Man.
Yeah. Here's a random thought I want to address. Multiple times, he refers to Asian people as Oriental. And I was like, ooh, obviously. But then I was like, well, this book is old. Like, when was that sort of becoming not cool to say? And I did Google it, and this I thought was actually very interesting, and maybe other people knew this, but the movement against using the term Oriental to describe people began in the 60s and 70s and tied into like the anti-Vietnam War. And I was like, that makes sense. And that's very interesting. And then also in federal law, the word Oriental was not fully replaced with Asian American until 2016.
Wow.
Oh, God, that is brutal.
That's a long time.
Yeah. Literally, thanks, Obama. Anyway, there's some Asian American people involved with the conspiracy as well. Okay, they're tracking down the people who have left town. A lot of them are sort of like scared and fucked up. We're also getting more visions of this guy named Kasif, who is a human man and a real wheeler dealer who's like a businessman. He's trying to take over the town through business.
Yes. And while they're on, while Marshall and Bernice are on one of these excursions, the car breaks down. And while Marshall's trying to fix the car, Bernice is like, I'm just going to go to this tavern because the angels made the car break down so that she could meet this guy, Kevin. Was his name Kevin?
His name was Kevin Weed.
Kevin Weed, who was her dead sister's roommate's ex-boyfriend.
Yeah.
And so she goes in this like sketchy bar and it's like, oh my God, Kevin, my dead sister's roommate's ex-boyfriend. And he's like, oh, you were my ex-girlfriend's roommate's little sister. And he's like, it's so weird. I actually just saw Susan, who was his ex-girlfriend slash the roommate of Bernice's sister, Pat, like very recently. And like, I gave her my number and it was wild. We broke up because some like hotshot guy, she started dating some hotshot guy and she didn't want anything to do with me anymore. And Bernice is like, okay, this is really important. If you hear from her at all, you have to tell her to call me. And he's like, okay, I can't imagine that I will, but this seems significant for plot reasons, so whatever. Because guess what? Susan calls him and tells him that he has to tell her that he has to contact Bernice and tell her that there was more to Pat's death than they thought.
This is about the time that I realized that this whole book is sort of like that Always Sunny meme of Charlie with all the notes and the string.
Yes. Thing,
except that just Jesus is written in the middle of the board.
Yes, 1000% that. Because we do over time learn after Susan has to like do some like crazy escape to get out of the house to call Kevin, and the angels stage a giant battle to distract the demons to allow her to do so. And we find out that Pat's suicide was not what it seemed, because actually she didn't die by suicide. She
was murdered by a demon who is possessing her body.
Yes.
And we learn that it's the same demon that's currently possessing Sandy, Marshall's daughter.
Yeah.
Through psychology.
The psychology demon.
Bernice is doing research on like the business deals around town. There's multiple scenes of her using microfilm.
Yes.
Which
I did think of you every time she used microfilm.
So stressful. Especially because people keep like threatening to kick her out of the office because, you know, this conspiracy is calling around all the office. I guess you can just go to a real estate office and be like, hello, can I use your microfilm? And normally they're like, yeah. But in this case, they're like, no, because of the conspiracy. But it's too late because she got a bunch of microfilm and learned that something called Omni Corporation owns like half of the town now. Suspicious.
And there's no reason to, we don't understand anything about like why they have to be sneaky about this, like why they couldn't just buy property. It's very confusing as to why any of this needed to be hidden in the first place.
Yes.
That's a good point. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, given that that's like basically what corporations do now without sneaking.
Yeah. Well, anyway, then Marshall visits, some other stuff happens, whatever. Marshall goes to visit his old friend from the New York Times, who tells him about Omni International / Omni Corporation. Quote, you wouldn't believe how influential they are in Arab oil, the common market, the World Bank, international terrorism. Your man Kasif, I want to tell you, he knows how to spill blood if he has to, and sometimes when he doesn't have to. I'd say this guy is a perfect cross between the ultimate guru and Adolf Hitler, and he makes Al Capone look like a Boy Scout. Word has it that even the mafia is afraid of him. And he's trying to buy a small liberal arts college.
I just want to point out how hilarious it is that you start with a reference to Hitler and then go to Capone, right? It's like, once you've dropped Hitler, Al Capone is not an intimidating figure anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of scenes of people being compelled to pray, and the angels are like, oh, thank goodness we have prayer covered now. And I love this idea that, like, it's like a prayer. It is like a video game. Like, you have to pray enough to, like, maximize the pray bar, And then once the bar is full, then the angels get a heart and then they can do something.
Then they get to do their ultimate move, which is how you defeat the demons, obviously.
Yes, yes. okay, things are really escalating. And this guy, Ted, who was the former editor, he calls Marshall all panicked. Marshall goes to Ted's place. It's trashed and he is dead by a gunshot wound to the head. He also goes to check on the former dean of the college whose place has been trashed, and that guy is missing. And then Marshall gets arrested, and this is when he gets a sense of how big the conspiracy is, because he's arrested by the Windsor Precinct cops, which is the town over from Ashton. And he's like, well, surely these people are not influenced by the global conspiracy.
But they are.
Can you fucking believe it?
Kevin Weed's house also is trashed. He is also missing.
And while Bernice is investigating Kevin's house, his apartment, because he's poor, she gets attacked in the stairwell of the apartment and she has to go to a hospital. When he's talking to Bernice in the hospital, the chief of police is like, yeah, you can get out of jail to go visit your friend in the hospital. Don't worry about it. And talking about her there, they realize that their secretary, Carmen, is a devil spy. And she's been telling the conspiracy everything that happens in the office. But yes. We already knew that as the reader, so it wasn't, like, that exciting.
Yeah. The angels at one point are like, listen, like, it's time for Marshall and Hank to struggle, because the struggle will make their fight so much sweeter in the end if we win. I don't know. They're essentially like throwing these guys to the wolves for God reasons. So the bank takes the paper away from Marshall.
Yeah, they're just like, by the way, like, you're behind on your payments and you haven't paid your taxes and your daughter is accusing you of rape. And he's like, okay. And yes. Then he gets in jail in the same cell with Hank.
And it's maybe worth noting that these two, our main characters, have not met before this point, despite being two of the most influential people in this small town.
Well, they needed the angels to bring them together in jail.
Not to, like, rewind to, like, the first thing that happens in the book, but that was the part that seemed the most insane to me, was when they're like, oh, pastor of one of the biggest churches in town, have you ever met the chief of police? And he's like, no, never. And I'm like, that seems, if the town is this small, that seems suspect.
I guess, to be fair, they are both new in town.
Yeah. It's a weird thing to lie about, like, whether you've met someone. It's like, no, it's a small town. I know everyone. What are we talking about here?
Yeah, so, where are we?
So, Hank and Marshall are in jail. They're praying. We're cutting over to Susan, Bernice's sister's old roommate, who we learned is called the capital M maidservant, and she's working for this terrible man, Kasif. That something's come over her and she wants to escape, and she is trying to get out and take some secret Omnicorp files, and they catch her trying to escape, but then she prays about it, and then she does escape, and then manages, it's very convoluted and who cares, but the main thing that you need to know is that Susan and Bernice sneak out and meet each other in a barn sneakily. And what really shocked me about this is Bernice has been, like, attacked and lost her glasses. And then she decides to go try to meet up anyway. And she drives without her glasses. And she says she knew it would be difficult, even dangerous, to drive without her glasses, but it was worth the risk. So the daylight was sufficient to make out the center line and the upcoming blobs. So she pressed on toward the big green bridge. But Bernice, what the fuck?
Really, Bernice, this is your hazard to yourself and others.
Jesus, take the wheel, Bernice. But it works, obviously, because angels are on their side. So they get some info from Susan. Marshall and Bernice realize that the police are tapping their phones. And Marshall is friends with the old police secretary, so he gets a key to get into the police office and to, like, find the big phone tapping device, And also all their, again, we're having scenes of them like reading spreadsheets, but they read the call logs and they figure out some more clues. They're running around. They're trying to get clues. It's kind of Carmen Sandiego vibes. Bernice is like still hurt from being attacked and she's like exhausted and she's about to give up. And then this like hot girl angel on a motorcycle comes and helps her. And up until this point, I was like, oh, I guess angels can only be dudes. But then there is one girl angel and her name is Betsy.
And I think it's supposed to be one of the boy angels, like in disguise as a human woman. But that doesn't really make that clear. It's just that this book hates women so much that it's impossible for you to imagine it actually thinks that women can be angels.
Yeah.
No, because then, let me find it. Because then at the end, when they're in the big battle, there's like a small curly haired angel whose like white robe suits her better than the motorcycle outfit or whatever.
Oh, okay.
So there's one girl angel.
Yeah. Betsy.
We're fat.
Eventually, the chief of police, after a lot of like struggle.
What really turns him is he realizes that they're about to like legit for real kill Sandy. And he's like, that's too far.
Yeah. So he decides that he's good now and he lets everyone out of jail to, you know, join in on the fight.
Yeah, which is all the humans are praying and like leveling up the angels, and then there's this big angel demon fight that is actually pretty boring, frankly. And meanwhile, God is angelically letting some phone calls get through, and they're able to talk to a heroic New York Times reporter, which is how you know this book's from a different era. And and also the state attorney general. And they're like, okay, we're going to get the word out because these people are not affected by the giant global conspiracy.
Which I do feel like is the opposite of every other, like, fucking...
It's a different time. Yeah, it's a different time. If this book came out now, you'd have to, like, tweet it on, what is it,
Well, I just feel like the times that the New York Times has been the godly, heroic savior has got to be, like, very minimal, even in the actual satanic panic.
Yeah, true.
It really is a glimpse into another time, because, like, the book points out that the conspiracy includes plenty of Europeans, too. Mm-hmm. But the implication seems to be that, like, the reason they need this small town is so they can start recruiting Americans. Which is a very strange, it's a very strange position to hold for a book like this.
Yeah. But hey, guess what? The good guys are able to win with guns.
Yes. Yes. Okay, because yeah, the angels and demons are fighting like in the sky, but on the ground at 2 p.m. there's like a vote or whatever for Omnicorp to buy the college. So the humans are like making these calls and like praying or whatever to stop Omnicorp from buying a college. And then at this like meeting where they're going to vote on selling the college or whatever, the police chief comes and shoots Professor Langstrat with a gun. Because as we all know, the only thing that can stop a bad guy with a demon is a good guy with a gun. And it's so weird because everyone else, like, who's possessed by demons, they get rid of the demons by praying and then they just, like, fly out their head or whatever. But this woman has to be shot with a gun.
Well, we have to understand that she is the worst of the worst, right? Like, she's even somehow worse than this. Than Kaseth, right? That because she's a woman who has power over men, so like, yeah, she has to have a particularly bad fate.
Yeah. Hey, she was in a neo-pagan cult, which could mean anything in this book, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it just means she has her PhD.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I think maybe it means she went to a women's studies class once. I don't know.
She has self-esteem. That's what it is.
PhD, more like pagans having drinks. Am I right, ladies? and then finally it ends. And it's about to end without Bernice being saved, but then something tells her to go back and talk to Hank. And he's like, again, we don't even get what he tells her, but it's like he told her God was good, and she was like, yeah, that sounds right. I'll go to church now. The end, finally.
Oh my God. This book, I don't understand how it was so long.
And like, there's a lot of plot, but so little of it really matters.
Yeah. And like, usually I'm a pretty fast reader, but I would read like one page of this and it would be like about paperclips. And I'd be like, well, surely I'm almost done now. And then Kindle would be like, you are 3% of the way through. And I'd be like, no.
I mean, I was listening on audio, so theoretically it should have taken the same amount no matter what. But it felt long.
It feels so, so long. And I think part of that is that, like, the only times that I can recognize, like, humanity in any of these characters is in the angels and demons. Like, they feel more like actual people than any of our heroes do, who spend all of their time telling us that they're having a great time praying and, like, having phone calls about vast conspiracies and never having a recognizable human emotion.
Yeah, even Bernice, like, you would think this backstory of, like, intrepid girl reporter trying to solve her sister's murder would be compelling, but it's not really.
No.
So, sorry, Bernie. Yeah, and also, like, especially the demons, like, they squabble amongst themselves, and that's also part of the reason why they're ultimately defeated is because they turn on themselves because they're demons and they're bad and they can't come together like good Christian angels can. Anywho,
did we mention that the climax, like, it takes place at this private college board meeting, or like the regents meeting?
Yeah
where they're like voting to sell the college. Yeah.
And I have been to regents meetings. They are the most boring thing imaginable, like 90% of the time. The fact that the plot hinges on this is endlessly hilarious to me.
Well, let's move on to dramatic readings and just poison your brains, listeners, with a little direct contact. So this first one, I'll be intrepid editor Marshall and Kate will be intrepid reporter Bernice. And we're going to tell you about what is going on at that college.
Have you looked over the flyer of elective courses Langstrad is teaching?
Marshall picked it up from his desk and could only shake his head incredulously. What in blazes is all this stuff? Introduction to God and Goddess Consciousness and the Craft? Colon, the divinity of man, witch, warlock, the sacred medicine wheel? How do spells and rituals work? You gotta be kidding.
Read on, boss.
Pathways to your inner light, meet your own spiritual guides, discover the light within, harmonize your mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual levels of being through hypnosis and meditation? What? How to enjoy the present by experiencing past and future lives?
I like the one near the bottom there. In the beginning, there was the goddess. Langstrat, perhaps?
Why hasn't anyone heard about all this before?
For some reason, it was never advertised in the school paper or in the public list of classes. Albert Darr gave me the flyer himself, and it said it was a somewhat exclusive pass-around item among the interested students.
And my little Sandy is sitting in this woman's class?
And in a way, so are all of those people on the list.
Marshall set down the flyer and picked up the list. He shook his head again. It was all he could think of to do.
I guess I don't mind it too much if a bunch of dupes want to be taken in by this Langstrat, but they're all so important. Look at that. Two of the college regents, the owner of the college land, the county comptroller, the district judge.
And Young, respected, revered, influential, community-involved Oliver Young. Marshall let some memory tapes play in his head. Yeah, it fits. It makes sense now, all that vague, non-committal stuff he was handing him in his office. Young's got a religion all his own. He's no hard-shell Baptist, I'll tell you that.
Religion I don't care about. Lies and cover-ups I do.
Well, he most certainly denied knowing Langstrat. I asked him directly, right to his face, and he told me he didn't know her.
Somebody's lying.
Oh my God, can you believe it? Also, for all my Sims players out there, every time I read the name Landstrat, I just think of one of the starting families in Sims, the Land Grabs. Which is very stupid, but every time. And they say her name a lot. I was like, oh, the Land Grabs are here. Anyway.
I also need to note that this passage reminds us that an important plot point is that the college is on somebody else's land for some reason, and that, like, the buying of the land is important for reasons that are never made clear.
You know, and maybe that is why the demons have picked this specific college, is because unlike every other college in America, this college is on land owned by some random person. All right, our next dramatic reading is, we're going to give you some cool demon stuff, and Izzy will be the demon prince Rafar, and oh my gosh, we didn't even talk about the strongman, who's like, in the MLM of demons, the strongman is up one from Rafar.
The evil in the room was thick and confining, the darkness like black liquid that swirled about with any motion of the limbs. The room was crowded. Baal Rafar, the prince of Babylon, a demon announced from somewhere, and monstrous demons all around the perimeter of the room bowed in respect. Rafar folded his wings in regal, cape-like fashion and stood with an intimidating air of royalty and might, his jewels flashing impressively, his big yellow eyes studied carefully. The orderly ranks of demons lined up all around him. A horrible gathering. These were spirits from the principality levels, princes themselves in their own nations, peoples, tribes. Some were from Africa, some from the Orient, several were from Europe. All were invincible. Rafar noted their tremendous size and formidable appearance. They all matched him for size and ferocity, and he doubted he would ever venture to challenge any of them. To receive a bow from them was a great honor, a compliment indeed.
Hail, Rafar,
said a gargling voice from the end of the room. The strong man, it was forbidden to speak his name. He was one of the few majesties intimate with Lucifer himself, a vicious global tyrant responsible over the centuries for resisting the plans of the living God and establishing Lucifer's kingdom on earth. Rafar and his kind controlled nations, those such as the strong man controlled Rafar and his kind. The strong man rose from his place, and his huge form filled that part of the room. The evil that emanated from him could be felt everywhere, almost like an extension of his body. He was grotesque, hulking, his black hide hanging like sacks and curtains from his limbs and torso, his face a macabre landscape of bony prominence and deep, folded furrows. His jewels flashed brilliantly from his neck, chest, arms. His big black wings draped his body like a royal robe and trailed along the floor. Rafar bowed in homage, feeling the strong man's presence from clear across the room. Hail, my lord.
Shall we be detained again?
The errors of Prince Lucius are being corrected. The new resistance is failing, my lord. Soon the town will be ready.
And what of the host of heaven?
Limited. The strong man did not like Rafar's answer. Rafar could feel that distinctly.
We have received reports of a strong captain of the hosts being sent to Ashton. I believe you know him.
I have reason to believe Tal has been sent, but I have anticipated him. The big velvet-draped eyes burned with fury.
Is it not this Tal who vanquished you at the fall of Babylon?
It is this Tal.
Then the delays have cost us our advantage. You have now been matched strength for strength.
My lord, you will see what your servant can do.
Bold words, Rafar, but your strengths can only succeed with immediacy. The strengths of our enemies grow with time.
All will be ready.
And what of the man of God and the newspaper man?
Does my lord even give them his attention?
Your lord wishes you to give them yours.
They are powerless, my lord, and will soon be removed.
But only if Tal is removed. Let me see it happen before you bother me in boasting about it. Until then, we remain confined here. Rafar, I will not wait long.
Nor shall you need to.
Do you have your orders? Begone!
Rafar bowed low, and with an unfurling of his wings, he quietly rose through the house until he was outside. Then, with a furious burst of rage, he swooped upward, sending unexpected demons tumbling out of his way. He picked up speed, his wings rushing in a blinding blur, and the defenders could barely get a channel opened before he burst through it, trailing hot steam of sulfurous breath. They closed up the channel again, giving each other curious looks as they watched him soar away.
Pretty cool. I
think. Those are the coolest parts in the book, as far as I'm concerned. Just demons being gross.
All right. And then our last dramatic reading is Kate reprising her role as Bernice and Izzy as Susan, a.k.a. the Handmaiden, a.k.a. Bernice's sister's roommate.
You may not want to read it just now. When I read that diary, well, it made me sick for days.
Susan, do you know how my sister really died?
Your sister Pat was methodically and viciously done away with by the Universal Consciousness Society, or should I say, the forces behind it. She made the same fatal mistake I've seen so many others make. She found out too much about the society. She showed herself to be an enemy of Alexander Kasif. Listen, what Kasif wants, he gets, and he doesn't care who has to be destroyed, murdered, or mutilated to make sure of it. I had to be blind not to see it happening to Pat. It was right out of the textbook.
So what about some man named Thomas?
Yes, it was Thomas. He was responsible for her death, but he wasn't a man.
Bernice was slowly catching on to this new game with its very weird rules. And now you're going to tell me it wasn't a woman, either.
Pat was taking a psychology class, and one of her requirements was that she be in a subject pool for psychology experiments. It's in the diary, you'll read it all. A friend persuaded her to volunteer for an experiment involving relaxation techniques, and it was during that experiment that she had what she called a psychic experience, some kind of insight into a higher world, she called it. I'll make it short. You can read it for yourself later. She became extremely enamored of the experience and saw no connection between this scientific exploration and the mystical practices I was into. She kept going back, kept taking part in the experiments, and finally contacted what she called a highly evolved, disembodied human from another dimension, a very wise and intelligent being named Thomas.
Bernice struggled with what she was hearing, but knew she had the documentation for Susan's account, her sister's diary. So who was this Thomas, really? Just a figment of her imagination?
Some things you're just going to have to accept for now. We've talked about God, we've toyed with the idea of angels, now let's try evil angels, evil spirit entities. To the atheistic scientists, they might appear as extraterrestrials, often with their own spaceships. To evolutionists, they might be highly evolved beings. To the lonely, they might appear as long-lost relatives speaking from the other side of the grave. Jungian psychologists consider them archetypal images dredged from the collective consciousness of the human race.
What?
Hey, listen. Whatever description or definition fits, whatever shape, whatever form it takes to win a person's confidence and appeal to his vanity, that's the form they take. And they tell the deluded seeker of truth whatever he or she wants to hear until they finally have that person in their complete control.
Like a con game, in other words.
It's all a con game. Eastern meditation, witchcraft, divination, science of mind, psychic healing, holistic education. Oh, the list goes on and on. It's all the same thing. Nothing but a ruse to take over people's minds and spirits, even their bodies.
Bernice reviewed memory after memory of their investigation, and Susan's claims fell right into place.
Bernice, we are dealing with a conspiracy of spirit entities. I know Kasif is crawling with them and takes his orders from them. They do his dirty work. If anyone gets in the way, he has numerous resources in the spiritual realm to clear away the problem in whatever manner is most convenient.
You're not the first person to try and tell me all this.
I hope I'm the last person who will have to.
Wow, really makes you think.
Certainly something.
Yep.
All right. Well, if that didn't convince you to want to read this book, let's move on to Reader's Advisory and suggest some stuff to read instead of or in addition to This Present Darkness by Frank Peretti. First of all, just to be clear, I really do not recommend reading this book, if that was not clear.
Avoid at all costs.
Oof. I've mentioned this book earlier this year, and I'm going to mention the series, actually, The Diviners by Libba Bray, which is so good, and it's so good at having this, like, big sprawling cast of characters who are, like, working together against, like, this creeping evil, but it's, like, cool and diverse and queer, and it's set in the 1920s and doesn't use Oriental, so that's cool. I mean, it's written later than this one, but you know what I mean. Anyway, also, I'll say it. I think that The King of Crows could be the strong man. I'll say it.
Yeah, I'd, if you're looking for a book that has magic powers, conspiracy, and intersecting plot lines, but that's, like, actually amazing and queer, check out Imma Terja's book, Ink, Blood, Sister Scribe, which is really great. And if you're looking for YA fantasy with witches that are heroes instead of shrews and cartoon villains, I loved H.A. Clarke's The Scapegracers.
Ooh, that sounds good.
And I'm just going to say, if you're looking for a convoluted mystery of someone trying to solve their what happened to their dead sister with lots of confusing mythology and religion, maybe just watch The X-Files.
Yeah.
Heck yeah.
There is a part, by the way, where Marshall asks Bernice if she believes in whammies, and all I can think of is Mulder and Scully, because also I've never heard anyone besides this book and Mulder and Scully use whammy to mean, like, I don't even know what it means, really, psychic interference or something. Quick shout out, obviously, if you like Angels and Demons, maybe like Good Omens, the book and or the show. Also, another great YA Jewish queer cool book with angels literally is When the Angels Left the Old Country by Sasha Lamb. We'll have these and maybe some other suggestions up on our website, worstbestsellers.com. Also, again, you should check out Izzy's book, These Fragile Graces, This Fugitive Heart. Check it out. Like I said, I haven't read it yet, but I bet that it doesn't have all the whack shit that this book has. So that's great.
I can confirm that it does not have that kind of whack shit.
Hell yeah.
Excellent.
All right. Now we'll move on to The Rock, Paper, Snicked, where, of course, Kate will say who Dwayne The Rock Johnson would be if he were in this book, and I'll say who Wolverine would be if he were in this book. And Izzy can choose which most enhances the book, or she can use paper, which is to leave it as is.
If Dwayne The Rock Johnson was in this book, he would simply just buy the land that the college was on and gift it to the college.
Baller move.
Yeah.
Well, if there's one thing that we know about Wolverine, is that he is a staunch conservationist, loves animals. So I think he would hear about Ashton UCC Church having a Save the Whales rally. He would attend that and be like, cool, love whales. He would realize the whole town was fucked, but then decide this wasn't like really his kind of a problem and his time could be spent better elsewhere. And so he would go off and somehow assist the scientists who have recently gotten the first photos of humpback whales having gay sex. Which wouldn't be covered in this book, but you would just know.
It has been a bucket list thing of mine to play Rock, Paper, Snicked with y'all. These are both great, but I'm always going to take gay humpback whales over land purchases. So I have to go with
Snicked. That's legit.
Hell yeah. You're not a member of the Land Grab Sims family. okay. I mean, in keeping with the very moralizing spirit of the book, Izzy, what do you think the moral of the story is?
I think the moral of the story is that not even God can make phone calls and prayer circles exciting.
That's so true. I think the moral of the story is don't save the whales because they're gay. And by the way, I believe that. I'm saying that's what the moral of the book is, obviously.
Yes. And I think the moral of the story is bring your psychology degree. Again, not what I would say, but I do believe that that is what the book is saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
100%.
Fortunately, my degree is in English. I'm safe. Now it is, of course, time for Duarte's Corner, where my cat Duarte will share his opinions about the book. You know, Duarte, I know, of course, that cats are often associated with witchcraft. And so you would think that, like, maybe Professor Landstrat would have a cat. But I think ultimately that would have made her, like, too cool and too powerful. And so Frank Peretti just couldn't allow that to happen.
Yeah. I mean, like, honestly, can you imagine a cat getting mixed up with all of this nonsense in this book? I think that all of the cats in this town were probably just off sleeping and ignoring this garbage.
Yeah, they made the wisest choice anyone could possibly make in this town, which is just ignore everything that's happening.
Yeah. Good for them. All right. Well, Duarte, thank you so much and I know, Duarte, it took you so long to read this book because it's so long and you're just such a little guy. So thank you so much for putting that time in and sharing your thoughtful critique of this book. Do any humans have any closing thoughts?
This was a long book.
It was so long. And the only parts that are remotely fun are like the gross descriptions of demons and the hunky angels hanging out and like being bros together, and neither of those comes anywhere close to justifying any of the other stuff in the book.
My closing thought is, I can't believe Amy Grant betrayed me like this. As someone who grew up listening to like crossover pop country music in the 90s, and I know she was originally a Christian artist, but you know, then she went secular and I listened to her, and she has a lot to answer for. That's all I have to say about that. Well, if you would like to come talk to us online, let us know your stance on whales. Maybe if you know what? I was going to, as a joke, say pray for us. And I was like, actually, I don't want to be involved with that. Just whales only, please. Find us on social media. We're on Facebook and Instagram and Blue Sky at Worst Bestsellers, spelled normally. And In Memoriam, our Twitter page is still up, but we're not really posting on it anymore. But that one is at Worst Bestseller with no S, because the S was taken over by a demon and we had to pray it away.
You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Amazon, Spotify, all of the places where podcasts are. You know what they are. And if you do find us on one of those platforms, please take a moment to rate and review. When you rate and review, it moves us up on the charts and makes it easier for new listeners to find us. If you don't rate and review, you might get not raptured. You might not be saved when the time comes, which, depending on your feelings, might be for the best. I'll leave that up to you, but think about our feelings too. We also have a Patreon at patreon.com/worstbestsellers. Patreon is a service where you pledge a small monthly recurring donation that goes to us to do things like keep our website up and running and keep our equipment up to date. And in return, there are perks for you, like postcards and stickers in the mail and a monthly bonus episode about what we're into these days. We also have merch available, which you can find by going to worstbestsellers.com and clicking on merch, where there's all sorts of designs from our podcast to wear on your body and leave behind on this earth when you're raptured. And also we have a Discord server, which you can also find linked from worstbestsellers.com, where you can come and talk to other fans of the show about new episodes, what you're watching on TV, what your cat's been up to, basically whatever you want.
Yeah, we would love to know what your cat's been up to, especially. Finally, you can find me and my cat online at Renata Snacks.
You can find me online at 14 across. And Izzy, where can people find you? And I imagine they can find you in their favorite local indie bookstore starting March 12th. But what about other places, perhaps on the internet?
Yeah, you can find me on Blue Sky and Instagram, and my handle is IZZYXEN at both of those places. I also have a website, but you can find that through those links as well. And yeah, you could find my book, These Fragile Graces, This Fugitive Heart. It's a queer science fiction cyber thriller set about 30 years from now in Kansas City, and it follows a trans woman who returns to the commune that she's living in exile from to investigate the death of her ex. And there's conspiracies and some spice and lots of thinking about what community in dark times looks like.
See, it sounds so much better than this book. Which is a low bar. I know that, but it sounds a lot better than this book.
I have a Midwesterner's aversion to speaking well of myself, but I can say confidently, yes, better than this book.
Hooray. Well, congratulations on that book. Thanks for joining us. We slogged through this, but you did too. So thank you for putting us all through it.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been a fan for years, and it's just a delight to be here with you. Thank you.
Aww.
Well, thank you. And listeners, thank you for listening. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with Fourth Wing by Rebecca Yarros.
Which finally, you've been asking for it.
Yeah, you've been horny for this one, listeners. Just like the dragons are horny, I think. I haven't started reading this yet. I think the dragons are horny. We'll report back soon on that. Bye.
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 PhD, more like pagans having drinks. Am I right, ladies?